This is a true crime in real time update from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Could the ballerina, the Black Swan ballerina that is known as Ashley Banfield, who was convicted of murdering her husband, get a new trial? The judge who presided over Ashley Banfield's murder trial is currently weighing whether or not the ballerina should get a new trial. In a motions hearing on Monday, Banfield's defense went and argued that a juror that was selected to be on that very jury was biased and did not disclose information about their past that could have tainted their guilty verdict. After hearing the arguments, the judge determined he needed to look at all the court filings by both defense and the state about the motion for a new trial before making a ruling. Before all of this, Banfield's sentencing was scheduled for Tuesday, but that has now been postponed. Let's go to the courtroom to hear that very hearing where those arguments were made.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. We're here in 2020 CF 3014, State of Florida versus Ashley Christina Banfield. Ms. Banfield is not present in court. Her presence has been waived by her attorneys, Mr. Taylor and Mr. Pinnell. Present for the state is Ms. O'Donnell and Ms. Friel. We're here today for the oral arguments, closing arguments related to the motion for new trial. When we were last here, Mr. Pinnell, you were not able to make it for some reason, so the request was made, as opposed to written closings, that we do them orally, and it was my understanding that you're going to be doing that, so that's why we continued it or left it on for today. Are you ready to go forward?
I am. I just want to confirm that you also received my written submission.
All right, so here's what I received recently. I have an email from you to my assistant. This is Sunday, October 20th, so yesterday at 3:35 p.m. It includes defendant's memorandum of law in support of motion for new trial based on juror misconduct, Exhibit A, Exhibit B, Exhibit C. I received an email yesterday, Sunday, October 20th at 3:38 p.m. from you. It says that attached is case law that was mistakenly omitted from the previous email. I received an email Saturday, October 19th at 1:13 p.m. from Ms. Duckett to my assistant. Attached is a file copy of the defense's motion for downward departure. And then another email Sunday, October 20th, so yesterday at 10:07 p.m., saying it was supplemental Exhibit 2 to the sentencing memo, and it was several letters. That's what I've received in the last couple of days. Did I get what I was supposed to get?
I submitted the memo and the four cases, and it sounds like you received both of those.
Yes, I did. State, did you submit anything that I was supposed to review?
I did on Monday of last week. State's response to defense motion for new trial based on juror misconduct. Post-juror interviews, did you receive that one?
I don't see it in any of my packets. It may be upstairs. If not, I'm sure Kelly is listening and she'll print out a copy for me.
Okay.
But I will say that I have not had a chance to review either your response, state, or the defendant's memorandum of law in support of motion, the three exhibits, although I think I've seen the three exhibits. Those look like transcripts that I already had, and the case law. None of it has been reviewed because obviously it just came in. All right, Mr. Pinnell, when we were here last time, I said I would give each side 15 minutes. It's your burden. Do you want to reserve any for rebuttal?
Can we reserve 4 minutes? And I believe Mr. Taylor was going to do 4 minutes, and then I would do, seven. Which I think is four plus seven plus four, I think equals 15. So yes, we're going to split the first 11, and then I'd like to do a four-minute rebuttal, if that's okay.
No, but one of you can, I don't mind if you split the first and the closing, or the rebuttal, but one person needs to make the first argument, second person needs to make the second argument, so... How do you want to split it up?
I was intending to take 4 minutes to present facts. Mr. Pinnell will take the remainder to present law. Of the remaining time, we want to reserve 4 minutes to be able to respond to the state's position. I would assume the court, as the state concludes, is going to ask Mr. Pinnell if he has any rebuttal. That was the reason why.
So if you want to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, that's fine, but I mean, Mr. Taylor, you've been doing this a long time. So if one of you wants to make the first, 11 minutes of argument, that's fine. But we're not going to split up the first 11.
When we were here last, Your Honor, I inquired about that, and I represented the court, as we did the last time, that I would do facts and this would be the law. The court indicated that was fine.
Sure, if you want to spend the first 11 minutes talking about facts and then the last four rebuttal, I don't think I even need to express how unusual it would be to split up an initial between two different attorneys. So one of you can present in the first 11 minutes, and then in the second, whatever you want to reserve for rebuttal, you certainly can reserve that.
I'll give us a moment. And I might add that the last time, that was exactly how we proceeded with the court's blessing. I did facts. Mr. Pinnell concluded by doing the law.
Which one? Which hearing?
When we were here last before Your Honor, where Mr. Pinnell was present.
It was on a motion to actually decide whether you're going to grant the interviews.
And it was?
For jury interviews, I did the initial factual representation. Than allowed Mr. Pinnell to be.
All right, listen, I'm not going to get... Okay, fine, whatever.
All right, so with that understanding, if it's okay with Your Honor, I need 4 minutes.
All right, you're on the clock.
Thank you. Three inquiries were made by the court with respect to the juror interviews, and I'm going to focus on number 15, Sarah Walker. Of those three inquiries, the first was the form, which was signed under oath, and the question was, have you ever been the victim of a crime, quote unquote. The second question that was asked by me during voir dire was, quote, have you ever been involved in domestic violence courts, unquote. And the third question that was asked by Assistant State Attorney Suzanne O'Donnell was, quote, have you ever had any dispute with a significant other about their child or the custody of their child, unquote. The answers that Ms. Walcott gave at the voir dire phase of the trial to the first question was no, she had not been a victim of a crime, and she signed the form under oath. As to the second question, she did not respond, have you ever been involved in domestic violence courts? And as to the third question, have you ever had any dispute with a significant other about their child or the custody of their child? She did not respond.
Judge, I apologize to interrupt, but there's someone on Zoom.
If they're coming in late, I'm not going to stop the proceedings.
Okay.
Go ahead, sir.
I'll take the 15 seconds, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
Her explanation at the inquiry that was made by the court as to the first question, you ever been a victim of a crime, was she took the position it was dismissed, so she didn't think it was applicable and did not equate domestic violence with a crime, despite the fact that Mr. Ballinger was handcuffed and arrested right in front of her. Number two, my question, have you ever been involved in domestic violence courts? Ms. Walcott said that too was dismissed. She did not think it was applicable as a result, and she did not understand the word involved. As to question number three, have you ever had any dispute with a significant other about their child or the custody of their child? Ms. Walcott said that too was dismissed, so she didn't think it was applicable, but she did acknowledge and admit to knowledge of injunctions and her ex-husband's decision to seek custody of their minor child, as well as admitting that there had been disputes about the minor child's custody between them. Now, I'd like to direct this to Rana personally, if I may. Based upon our culture, our education, and our social status, which I would suggest is quite similar, if not identical, as a parent, when you ask your child, did you say this? Did you write this? Did you do this? Words have their ordinary and intended meaning. And that is a phrase we hear and see repeated in appellate decisions ad nauseum. There is an expectation, Your Honor, as a parent, that the response will be direct and truthful. And the reason is because you will use that to evaluate the remedy that you believe to be appropriate as a result of the conduct. Now, I want to repeat the three questions that were asked.
That's the time. I'll give you the extra time for the interruption. Go ahead.
Three questions. Have you ever been a victim of a crime? Have you ever been involved in domestic violent courts? Have you ever had any dispute with a significant other about custody of your child? What is confusing about any of those questions? What is not clear about any of those questions? While at no moment for purposes of this hearing, Judge White, she lied when she came in here and gave those explanations, and everyone present in this courtroom knows she lied, whether they refute it, whether they object to it, or they choose to remain silent. But here's the thing. Here's the essence, the gravamen of this dilemma. It doesn't matter if she lied or not, because it's not about her. It's about us, the defense, Ms. Benefield, and what we knew as a result of her answers.
All
and
right,
given our remaining peremptory challenge, we would have excused her had the court not excused her for cause.
Sir, that's your 4 minutes.
My
I gave you the additional time.
Last sentence. May I?
Go ahead, Mr. Pinnell.
Thank
you have 7 minutes. You're on the clock.
Judge, it's our position that this is obviously an important decision of the court, but it's a straightforward analysis under the binding decisions of the Florida Supreme Court in De La Rosa and Roberts, and of the second DCA in the Fegan case that we provided to the court. It's now indisputable that Juror 15 gave dishonest answers and incomplete information to the court in response to the questionnaire and during voir dire. Based on that information, Ms. Benefield and her attorneys were not able to make an informed decision as to whether they would exercise a peremptory challenge to her serving on the jury. And the second DCA in the Fegan case says that a defendant has an inalienable right to make a peremptory challenge based on full knowledge and a complete disclosure by the juror. And Mr. Taylor's correct. Whether Juror 15 did it intentionally or not is irrelevant under the case law. It's the effect on the defendant and
her ability to make an informed decision about a peremptory. It's our position that the most egregious of the omissions by Juror 15 was her failure to acknowledge that she had been involved in domestic violence court. At the subsequent hearing, she acknowledged she was the petitioner in a domestic violence petition, and the court has copies of that petition. At the top of the petition, it says, petition for protection against domestic violence. So it makes no logical sense. She wouldn't understand that. She was also, more importantly, the respondent in two domestic violence injunctions, also entitled on top, petition for protection against domestic violence. And in the second one, her husband, and they're both filed by her ex-husband. The first one was her ex-husband and her son, their son, and then the second was on behalf of the son. In the second one, the ex-husband specifically asked for custody and was awarded temporary custody of the minor child. So her answers that she did not know that she was involved in domestic violence courts are disingenuous and misled the defense in its decision-making process. Most importantly, the omissions are material, and there's a three-part test under De La Rosa. One, one of the elements is, did the juror conceal information? I think that's undisputed at this point. Two, is the information relevant and material to jury service in this case? And what the De La Rosa case says is, if a potential juror is similarly situated to the opposing party, then it makes reasonable sense that the other party will want to exclude that person for cause or a peremptory. Here, by being the respondent and allegedly committing acts of domestic violence in a family situation, accused of threats and misconduct, it is similar to the allegations that Ms. Benefield made against Douglas Benefield. So those particular, the fact that she was a respondent in those two cases makes her similarly situated to Douglas Benefield and makes it clear that had that information been properly disclosed, Mr. Taylor and Ms. Benefield would have been suspicious of her, believe she may have been biased, and would have exercised a cause or a peremptory challenge. The third factor was the failure to close the information attributable to the complaining party's lack of diligence. And those cases discuss the sufficiency of the questions asked by the lawyers. And as Mr. Taylor, I think, adequately indicated, the questions in this case could not be any more clear. Have you been a victim of a crime? Were you involved in domestic violence cases? And have you been involved in a dispute about child custody with a significant other? There's nothing about those questions that are unclear. And if you look at the Roberts case, got it. In that case, they just asked about litigation, and the potential juror, apparently the explanation was that they didn't specifically say domestic assault or injunction, but they just said litigation was enough. Here we were more specific. There was domestic violence courts and custody. In the Taylor case, Taylor versus Magana.
Yes, sir.
Under head note 11 of the opinion, they found that the questions were satisfied the due diligence inquiry because they were specific, unambiguous, and not cluttered with sophisticated or confusing legalese. Again, the questions here could not be more clear. It's our position that we've established the three-part test under De La Rosa. That shifts the burden to the state to show that any error was harmless. under the facts of this case, they cannot meet that burden. And it's our position that the court is required by De La Rosa, Roberts, and the Feagin case to grant the motion.
Thank you, sir. You're on the clock.
I just want to respond briefly to what counsel said about the Roberts case. If Your Honor reads the Roberts case, they did ask initially in the questionnaire about litigation, but one thing that was very important to the court was that Roberts' attorney during voir dire clearly clarified this inquiry, and he said, has there been any kind of lawsuit, divorce, collection of a debt, breach of contract, assault and battery, auto accident, defective product, medical negligence, divorce, domestic assault? And that's pretty clear. So that's why the Roberts case said it was clear in the Roberts case. It wasn't because of the questionnaire that said, have you ever been involved in a lawsuit? And if Your Honor reads this case, I think you'll see that the court would have a very different opinion if it had just been the questionnaire itself. So I do agree with the De La Rosa three elements that the defense has to prove. I do not agree that they have met those burdens. These facts are not undisputed whatsoever. I think the only one that could be termed as undisputed is the first thing that the defense mentioned, that was the questionnaire for juror 15 marked no when it said, have you ever been a victim of a crime? She testified that she answered no because she misunderstood. However, I do agree that that does not make a difference when you're looking at the case law. But nonetheless, she did raise her paddle, Judge, later on when the defense asked, has anyone experienced an abusive male? She raised her paddle. She testified that she raised her paddle, or it's in her letter that she gave to the court. Also, in Mr. O'Keefe's affidavit, Exhibit A, where it says experience abusive male, and it has the number 15 written down. She raised her paddle. So even if she said on her questionnaire she was not a victim of a crime, she did raise her paddle when she said, I've experienced an abusive male. So I don't think that it's clear that this was not rectified and remedied with that question. However, even if the court believes that it was not rectified, the defense never followed up with any of these questions when they asked, has anyone ever experienced an abusive male? The defense never asked juror 15 any questions about this abusive male, never exercised due diligence, which is the third prong of the De La Rosa test. And also, Judge, and maybe most importantly, is that this issue, being a victim of a crime, is not material or relevant to the jury service of juror 15. That even if she withheld this info, that she was the victim, and that's all we're talking about here, the victim of domestic violence, wouldn't that make her more sympathetic to Ashley Benefield, who is claiming she was the victim of domestic violence? So to insinuate the opposite, I think, would be disingenuous. I think it would align her more with the defendant than it would Doug Benefield. And perhaps most importantly is this issue could not have been that material because another juror, according to Mr. O'Keefe's affidavit, raised their paddle when they were asked, have you ever experienced an abusive male? Number 35 raised her paddle, and she was seated on the jury. She was never struck, and she was never asked any questions about the abusive male. So it's hard for the defense to try and say that this is material when they did not treat juror 35 any differently than they did juror 15. So the state's argument is that they have not met their burden, the De La Rosa factors on the first issue. The second issue is, have you ever been involved in domestic violence courts? First of all, Judge, the term domestic violence courts is very vague. I don't even know that I know what a domestic violence court is. Is that criminal? Is that civil? Is this an injunction? Is this a divorce decree? What exactly is this? And I think it was incumbent upon the attorneys to establish that and to flesh that out. And if you took the defense's transcript, or you were here, they did not delve into that domestic violence courts and did not expound any on what exactly is a domestic violence court. Just because there's an injunction doesn't mean that anyone ever went to court or that anyone ever argued it or that a decision was ever made. So as to whether the information was concealed, this information was never concealed because these items were the injunctions, which is what we're specifically talking about, were dismissed. They were not litigated. There was no follow-up questions by the defense, so there was no due diligence. And then I would argue again that they're not material or relevant to this jury service, and it would be the same argument as the previous issue. As to the last issue, have you ever had a child custody dispute? That was something that I asked. Juror 15 testified that she does not recall whether she raised her paddle or not. So I don't know that we can say that she didn't raise her paddle, but she said she did not recall. She did say that she did not see these issues with injunction as child custody dispute. She said to Your Honor that nobody filed for any motion to amend child custody, or nobody went to court for a divorce court or family court to amend the custody agreement. And Judge, if you notice from the transcript, the state never defined what child custody dispute meant. I never went into what exactly that meant. I never asked them specifically. I just asked child custody. There is a real possibility that these allegations were not even termed as disputes. Just because someone makes an allegation doesn't mean that there's this contentious dispute. It's just someone making a wild allegation. The wild allegation is dismissed. So she did not withhold the information because, technically speaking, there were no child custody disputes. There were no motions to amend child custody. And again, the defense did not follow up with the questions because the defense did do questions after the state's questions. They did not expound or clarify any of the issues related to child custody. So for these reasons, I would say that the defense has not met their burden under De La Rosa, and I would ask you to deny.
Hello, Mr. Pennell. I had to look at my phonetics. Apologize.
It should be. The way it says, it's an E, so I no worries.
So you actually had 30. A little bit of time left from before, so I'm going to add that in. So you have four and a half minutes.
Appreciate it, Judge.
Yes, sir.
The state's focus is in our position. Our position is misplaced. Their focus overly on the abusive male question. Certainly, there's a difference between encountering an abusive male, and you could be abusive verbally, physically. Doesn't necessarily make you a crime victim. That's besides the point. When you read our memo, you'll see that we're relying primarily on the omissions in response to the question about domestic violence courts and child custody. And to suggest that an individual that filled out a petition, filed it in court, and the petition is entitled Petition for Protection Against Domestic Violence, doesn't know that they're involved in domestic violence courts, or that the question wasn't sufficient, defies logic. I no one can reach that conclusion. No reasonable person can reach that conclusion. The question's clearly sufficient. She filed it with the court. Then there was two petitions filed against her in court with the same title. And the idea that it's not a dispute, well, I don't know, the last time I checked, the court cases said, quote, ex-husband versus Juror 15. Seems like a dispute to me. He's asking for custody until she's mentally stable. The judge grants a temporary injunction, and that's Exhibit D of the memo, and the judge grants custody. If that's not a dispute about custody, I don't know what is. So the questions were clear on their face. The answers are obviously evasive, and there was an omission. And there's no evidence that any of these questions were vague or unclear. The other jurors raised their paddles. They didn't have any problems. It was only juror 15. So it's our position, and again, by being a respondent who is alleged to have committed acts of domestic violence against her ex-husband, which also involved a child they had together, puts her in a similar situation as Douglas Benefield. And this isn't just me saying it, this is De La Rosa. This is the case from the Florida Supreme Court that both sides agree is the controlling decision. And it says, quote, a person involved in prior litigation may sympathize with similarly situated litigants. In these circumstances, counsel must be permitted to make an informed judgment as to the prospective juror's impartiality and suitability for jury service. That was not, Ms. Benefield did not have that option here. Ms. Benefield's lawyers did not have that option here. Because she did not raise her paddle to the involvement in domestic violence cases with full knowledge that she'd been involved in at least 3 domestic violence injunctions. So, under De La Rosa, she's similarly situated to Douglas Benefield, and I think the case law requires the court to grant the motion. And I don't have any additional argument, but if the court has any questions, I'm happy to answer. If the court has questions about any of these arguments, because to me, the law, again, the Florida Supreme Court, De La Rosa, Roberts, and the more recent case from the second DCA, all binding decisions, simply require the court to grant the motion. No one likes to do a trial twice, but yeah, the defendant's entitled to a fair trial. That didn't happen here, so we'd ask that the court grant the motion.
All right. Thank you both very much. Obviously, I received quite a bit of information. Even state, I haven't had a chance to review your response with the hurricane. Let me also say I hope everybody's homes and families are okay from these 2 storms that came through. I wanted to really wait until today to hear the arguments from both sides. Obviously, I kind of went into the weekend thinking that I wasn't going to have any memos or case law sent to me. It's all last minute. So I have not had a chance to review it. I think, in all fairness, it's important that I review both sides, the response from the state, the memo from the defense, the case law. I think, as you mentioned the names, I believe that I already had all of those, but certainly go through all of that. So I really wanted to wait to see how much I had and whether I thought that I might be able to make a decision and get an order written today. And I leave this hearing firmly convinced I'm not going to get it done today. So we're not going to be able to do the sentencing hearing tomorrow. I don't know when it's going to be rescheduled. I'll have Kelly reach out to both sides to schedule it. What are we set for tomorrow? 3 hours?
I don't think, Your Honor, but respectfully, we had a limitation on the time frame.
It was set for 2 hours, Judge.
Yeah, I set limitations on scheduling. Whenever we set it up, I always say, how much time do you need for your portion of it?
I would like to hope we can get it done in 2 hours. It might be a little tight. To the extent the court could stand it, I'd ask that the court allot 3 with the understanding that we can wrap it up.
For both sides? Or just your side?
I think we're going to need probably 2 hours for our side because we're going to have some testimony.
All right. State? I think last time we talked it was an hour and an hour, but now it's 2.
An hour.
All right. So 3 hours. I'll have Kelly reach out to both of you to find a day and time that works for everybody. And I will endeavor to get a written order out on this. What I'm saying is I don't know how I'm going to rule on this. There's quite a bit of information to review. But I want to go ahead and set the sentencing hearing so we have a day and a time. And then depending on what my ruling is, obviously if I grant it, then there is no sentencing hearing. We pick another trial date. If I deny it, then at least we've got it on the record for a sentencing.
Two matters, if I may. Number one, just to advise the court, I leave Wednesday for an out-of-town trial that's going to run approximately 2 weeks.
All right.
Number two is I would, based upon the court's decision to vacate the sentencing hearing for tomorrow, respectfully renew for Ms. Benfield our motion for bond to the trial court. I don't know when the sentencing hearing now will be rescheduled. I think it's a reasonably fair bet that the court hasn't reached a decision on this issue. I think it's a troubling issue. And I think for those reasons, Your Honor should reconsider her bond status. And I would ask that the court admit her to bond pending sentencing. She's demonstrated for 3 years absolute compliance with every requirement imposed upon her. There has never been one issue related to Ms. Benfield's bond. And in fact, on multiple occasions, when she needed some relief, we petitioned the court. The court was always kind about it, and I think unanimously granted it each and every time. I don't even think the city opposed it. But the point being that she's never shown anything but respect for the opportunity to be out on bond, and any indication whatsoever that she will be here and her family, as the court knows, is here as well.
All right. Well, obviously that wasn't noticed today. The only way I can hear that is by consent of the parties, since it wasn't noticed.
No consent.
Well, we had filed a bond motion, Your Honor, the court denied.
Yes, sir. But it wasn't noticed for today. And as you're well aware, I can't hear matters that aren't properly noticed except by consent of the parties. All right. Thank you all very much.
That's the latest from the courtroom. What will the judge decide on Ashley Benfield? We'll bring it to you as soon as the decision is made. I'm Tony Bruschi. Press subscribe and stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast. In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.